This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
That speech last night, it was all economy, really. And you know what? The truth is we can't have everything we want. So how to decide what to pay for? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, the 13th of February. Good as always to have you with us. And hey, that didn't take long now, did it? The president was barely into his post-State of the Union road trip when House Speaker John Boehner poured cold water all over one of the key economic items in the president's speech last night. He proposes raising the minimum wage to $9 an hour. And Mr. Boehner said this morning, why would you want to do that? It'd hurt small businesses, he said, and kill jobs. Now, there is some disagreement among economists about whether minimum wages help by putting more money in the hands of the lowest paid workers or hurt by encouraging employers to eliminate jobs. So we figured let's go ask some people with their wallets on the line. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner starts us off.
At the Marmalade Cafe in El Segundo, California, the breakfast potatoes are hot on the grill and guys like Alejandro Servin are hard at work.
My job is run food for customers.
Servin is a food runner. He helps the wait staff serve food. He sets tables, boxes up leftovers. Right now, he's working about 30 hours a week, earning California's $8 minimum wage, plus about $35 a day in shared tips. Would a raise to $9 an hour make a difference?
Yeah, it's so much different for me because I have a family, had to support, had to pay bills. Insurance.
Servin and his wife, who works as a cook, have a three-year-old and pay about $1,000 a month in rent, not unusual for Los Angeles. He's hunting for a second job. Selwyn Yaslowitz is one of the Marmalade Cafe's founders. He says a dollar increase in the minimum wage would likely force him to raise prices or cut labor costs.
Maybe make the hours more efficient. For example, people come in at 9 o'clock right now, I make sure they come in at 9:30. And cut off half an hour across the board to be able to afford the increase.
Servin and a co-worker say they're already sent home early when business is really slow.
We work in just 2 or 3 hours. It's hard.
If Congress raises the minimum wage, that ultimately may help boost all the wages at a place like the Marmalade Cafe, including the better-paid cooks frying those breakfast home fries. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
It was more than just the minimum wage in the speech last night. Let me play a quick piece of tape from the president, and we'll pick it up with David Leonhardt from the New York Times.
Our work must begin by making some basic decisions about our budget, decisions that will have a huge impact on the strength of our recovery.
David's got a new book out about those decisions, about those choices we're going to have to make about our debt and our deficit. It's called Here's the Deal. David, good to talk to you again.
It's good to be back, Kai.
I'm going to quote you to yourself to get us going. You say in this book, in the simplest terms, Republicans have won the debate on taxes. Democrats have won the debate on benefits. We, the voters, have chosen the winner of each, which, if I can extrapolate, means we kind of lose, right? Because we're not paying for what we want.
That's right. We're pro-deficit. we say we're not. We say the deficit's a terrible thing. But then you come back to us and you ask us, are we willing to pay higher taxes? No. Are we willing to accept fewer Medicare or Social Security benefits? No. Do we want to make big cuts to the military? Mostly no. And that's really the deficit.
Your salve, your bomb, your remedy for this is economic growth. but how? I mean, it's easy to say, harder to get there.
I think that's a really important point. And so I think the lesson is that the government needs to do some things that the private sector won't do. And this is basic research. It's not picking winners. It's not ethanol. But it's things like scientific research at the very basic level. It's things like education. It's things like building roads and the 21st version of roads, broadband. I mean, Kai, if you look at it, it's really interesting. The internet, radar, penicillin, the jet engine, the radio, all these things started as a government program. And they started because this really early stage stuff isn't profitable. And so you need someone other than the private sector to do it.
This is a fundamentally optimistic book. You believe, and I tend to agree with you, that we can fix a lot of the problems that face us, and that this is a country with potential and reason to be hopeful about its future. I would suggest, though, David, that you have not, and I know this is facetious on the face of it, you have not considered the politics of this thing, because all that you say in this book will not, in the present circumstance, ever happen.
That's correct. And that's a fair critique.
Okay, then. Thanks for coming.
And I don't think that politicians or voters are suddenly going to come to their senses and that everything's going to be fine. But I also think that we have the capability of getting this right. And I don't think there's any other country in the world that comes into the 21st century economy with a bigger set of advantages than us.
Do the crises that we have coming up, manufactured, I grant you, but the sequester and the debt limit and all of the things will be coming in the next 4 to 6 months, does that provide impetus for any of this that you talk about?
You would certainly hope so, wouldn't you?
I mean, yes, I would.
There's never going to be this grand bargain, it's now clear. But first, there was a deal in 2011 that just cut spending. And it wasn't perfect, but it really did cut spending in some ways. Then there was this deal at the end of 2012 that raised taxes. And it wasn't perfect, but it really did raise taxes. And so you can fight over the precise numbers, but we've made some substantial progress, which is why I think it's not unreasonable to think that these manufactured crises, as damaging as they are, could be the impetus for more progress.
David Leonhardt is the Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Times. He's got a new book out. It's called Here's the Deal. It's a Kindle single. It's a quick read. Give it a shot. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
On Wall Street today, a breather, a break. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Our wealth and poverty team has been spending some time in Chicago this week looking at the economic realities of the violence there. Gun violence in general, housing policy in particular, and what it has to do with the violence. Chicago has a long history of racially charged housing policies. Things got so bad with segregation, dense pockets of poverty, that the Supreme Court stepped in and ordered the city to fix it. One approach was a series of experiments that moved people from poor neighborhoods to middle-class ones, mobility counseling programs, they were called. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark explains.
Good morning, good morning, good morning.
We like to say in America that you can make it no matter where you come from.
Welcome to the mobility counseling program. I'm Miss Johnson.
But Miss Shanette Johnson, the woman welcoming a half dozen people into the offices of Housing Choice Partners in downtown Chicago.
You're welcome to get coffee and donuts.
Miss Johnson has a different message, which she explains as she projects a giant map of the city onto the front wall.
First, we're going to talk about all of the polka dots on the map.
Johnson's mobility counseling workshop is based on the idea that the polka dot you live in directly affects your future success in life, your income, your health, the quality of your education, and that you can profoundly change all that just by moving to a different polka dot. One, she explains, with
good schools,
low crime,
jobs close to home.
Workshops like these help low-income families move to places like that with help from federal rent vouchers. That's why Crystal Stribling is here. She says she wants out of the neighborhood she lives in now.
I have a 12-year-old boy. I want him to be able to go outside without nobody trying to induct him into a gang and all that stuff, because he's very smart in school, and I want him to be the next president.
The problem is Stribling isn't sure where to go. And that's where mobility counselors like Miss Johnson come in.
A lot of people are stuck within the four corners of their old neighborhoods. That's all they know.
Johnson says if you don't have a car, if all your family and friends have lived in the same place for generations, then even if you have the will to move, it can be hard to find the way.
For example, Garfield Ridge. Who knows what Garfield Ridge is?
She puts this to her audience, and nobody answers.
Nobody knows where Garfield Ridge is?
So she points to Garfield Ridge on the map. It's near Midway Airport, and starts singing its praises.
Now, in that area alone is 19,000 jobs. Hotels, motels, Holiday Inns, TGF Fridays. So that's opportunity for us and our families to grow and prosper, correct?
Everybody's taking notes. Mobility programs have been around for a couple decades in Chicago and have spread to other cities. The big question now is, do they work? Can moving from one polka dot to another really affect a life down the road?
This is my backyard. It's real peaceful.
That's Saida Harris, 8 years ago, right after she moved from a public housing project in Chicago to a middle-class suburb where she didn't know a soul. She was 35, single, and had just given birth to her fourth child. In the tape, you can hear the baby cooing in the background.
I didn't want another generation of my family being stuck. I wanted them to strive for much more.
I recently tracked down Harris and her family again.
Hi.
They live in another Chicago suburb now. And that little baby, she's old enough to introduce herself.
Tanaya.
And what grade are you in?
Second.
Tanaya has had a very different childhood from the rest of her family. She knows her brother and sisters grew up in a poor neighborhood. She's visited it a few times.
They shoot there and their boys' pants go down. They're sex.
And they don't do that here?
Uh-uh.
Tanaya's older sister, Naosha, was in middle school when her family moved. Now she's about to graduate college with a double major in business and education. She might be exactly where she is today, even if she'd never left her old neighborhood. But sometimes she wonders.
I just see the people I actually grew up with, like when we go back. And it's like, oh, wow, if I was still here, like, would I have a baby like they would, or dropped out in high school like they did? I'm just really grateful that I did have opportunities.
Opportunities and new expectations. Naosha says at her old school,
I was student of the year every year. It was no competition. And then it's like once I moved, I wasn't student of the year anymore. Like I had to actually work hard to get back to where I was.
It uncovered abilities that people didn't know they had.
James Rosenbaum is a sociologist at Northwestern University. He says mobility programs don't always work out. Some families face isolation or discrimination in their new neighborhoods. Some move back to their old ones. But Rosenbaum says geography clearly has some real power over destiny. He's tracked hundreds of families who've moved from Chicago housing projects to remote middle-class suburbs and compared their kids years later to the ones who'd stayed behind.
They were more likely to graduate high school. They were more likely to go to college. If they didn't go to college, they were more likely to have a job. Down the line, really big improvements.
Still, you might ask, instead of uprooting people from their neighborhoods, why not invest in those neighborhoods and bring more opportunities to them? That's important, Rosenbaum says, but it also takes time. And kids grow up fast. In Chicago, I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Coming up, the KGB on what's great about the USA.
We've been here a long time. What's so bad about it, you know? The electricity works all the time. Food's pretty great. Closet space.
Is that what you care about?
No, I care about everything.
Not the motherland.
I do, but our family comes first.
But first, let's us do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave it back 0.25% today. 35 points ended at 13,982. The NASDAQ picked up 0.3%, 10 points, 3,196. The S&P 500 took home less than 0.1%, not even a point, finished at 1520. J.P. Morgan Chase dumped nearly 1% today. Goldman Sachs picked up 0.25%. Citigroup threw off 0.7% today. Comcast chalked up a gain of nearly 3% on news it would buy the part of NBC Universal that it doesn't already own. GE, which is unloading its stake, gained even more, lit up 3.5% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.03%. Yes, I said two. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. A House Subcommittee on Commerce, Manufacturing, and Trade holds a hearing on the state of manufacturing in America. February is American Heart Month, a month to focus on heart health. The government says cardiovascular disease costs Americans more than $300 billion a year. And speaking of matters of the heart, tomorrow is Valentine's Day. Spend a few bucks on a nice card so your honey bunny doesn't kill you. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Intel, the chip company, is best known, totally known, come to think of it, for what its products do inside your computer. Well, it turns out Intel has decided to get into something a little more visible, internet television. Not exactly an untapped area, no, but the Intel TV is going to watch you, as Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports.
To sell you more ads, tech companies are trying to make gadgets that get to know you. Enter Intel, which is producing a TV set-top box that'll deliver internet TV and will have a built-in camera that'll recognize you. Michelle Rates is an analyst at Gartner.
It really is just about personalization, having the ability to recognize you and then give you options that are tailored to you. So, for instance, if it's your, you know, six-year-old kid,
the TV might say, "Hey, Junior, here's some cartoons you can watch."
Where if I would walk into the room, it might put on American Idol or something like that.
Privacy, of course, is going to be an issue. But the internet TV space is getting crowded, and tech giants from Google to Apple and Samsung need to find a way to differentiate themselves. Vijay Rakesh is an analyst at Stern AG. He says computer chips have been Intel's bread and butter, but the market is slowing down, and Intel needs to pivot towards smartphones, tablets, and other mobile devices.
Your TV, there is mobile connectivity. In your cars, there is connectivity. It's always an opportunity for somebody like Intel to step in.
Brian Steinberg is an analyst with Tech Savvy. He says the living room is the one frontier that no tech companies captured.
There's no single one innovation that's really revolutionized it in the way that the iPhone did smartphone.
And if Intel can capture the TV, then it'll get closer to capturing all the devices, your phone, your tablet, that talk to it. I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Among the lesser commented upon parts of the president's speech last night was where he said the United States and Europe have agreed to talk about a transatlantic free trade deal. EU leaders gave the plan a thumbs up today. It'll be the biggest trade agreement of its kind ever negotiated. Talks to begin sometime before June. 2 or more years until anything is final, if, as Marketplace's Stephen Beer tells us, it's ever made final at all.
This is going to be like two elephants trying to mate, said one analyst here today. More of a collision than a delicate intertwining. Economist Simon Tilford says the two sides will struggle to open their markets fully to each other's farm produce.
When they get down to the nitty-gritty, it's possible that the negotiations will again founder on some of the cultural differences between the EU and the US, for example, over things such as genetically modified food.
Which is banned in most of Europe. And then there's American poultry that's been washed in chlorine.
In countries like Germany and Italy, there's almost hysteria about such things.
On the other hand, says fund manager Justin Urquhart-Stewart, US farmers may not be entirely sympathetic to Europe's vast system of farm subsidies.
The common agricultural policy was designed by the French, for the French, and primarily for the French peasant farmer, to keep an idyll of a way of life going, and it is suitably subsidised.
He describes the long-running culture war between US and European farming as Bourbon meets Burgundy. They'll never mix. Some find it heartening an attempt is underway to sink some of these cultural differences, but Gillian Tett of the Financial Times is not reassured.
It indicates just how desperate both the Americans and the European governments are to find something, anything, that can reignite growth at a time when many of the other policy options are frankly running out of steam.
But even she admits this is the world's biggest trading relationship and worth nurturing. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The president talked last night about, well, he talked about a lot of things, but he talked a good deal about the economic importance of education and infrastructure, which does seem kind of obvious. What is not so obvious, though, is how to pay for them when government spending is looking at huge cuts. Commentator Robert Reich says the trick is to treat public investments differently.
No rational family would borrow to pay for a vacation, but not borrow to send a kid to college. And no rational business would borrow to pay current salaries, but not take out a loan to buy crucial new machinery. Yet that's in effect what our government does, because it doesn't distinguish between current spending and public investment needed to ensure future economic growth. A rational federal budget would allow additional borrowing for public investments whenever the expected return on those investments is higher than the cost of the borrowing. And it wouldn't borrow a penny if the return on the investment is less than the borrowing costs. Studies show for every dollar we invest in infrastructure, we can expect a return of nearly $2 in economic gains. Of course, we need to make sure these investments are smart. No bridges to nowhere. Still, no one can argue that much of our infrastructure is badly outdated. Investing in early childhood education gives us an even bigger bang, a return on investment of between 10 and 16%. A better educated workforce means greater productivity. Capital markets are now global. Money sloshes across borders in search of the highest return anywhere. The only way to ensure private investors continue to invest in America and support the high living standards we want is for Americans to be highly productive. This requires public investments, which is why we need a public investment budget separate from a current spending budget, one that can't fall victim to partisan bickering and will allow us to keep borrowing when the return on public investment and the public good justifies it.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Beyond Outrage. You want to tell a good story, you could do a lot worse than using the Cold War as a backdrop, Russian spies and the CIA, capitalists versus communists, and though not really fun at all, the constant threat of nuclear war. The new drama on FX, The Americans, it's called, takes us back to 1981. And two Russian sleeper agents sent here years ago in an arranged marriage. A couple of kids now living near Washington. Sinister, but not nearly as evil as we like to remember those Russians being. So today on our occasional series, The Art of Money, How Artists and Others Think About the Economy, Joe Weisberg and Joel Fields, the creator and executive producer of that show. Good to have you both with us, guys.
Good to be here.
Hello.
So, Joe, let me ask you this. You go into the good people at FX and you say, listen, I've got an idea for a spy series set in 1981. It's the Russians, the bad guys, and we're the good guys. What did they say?
Well, I didn't actually say the Russians are the bad guys and we're the good guys. I said the Russians are the good guys. And the amazing thing was they didn't even blink. And that's really why we're here today with this show.
Joel, it was by design that you made these two be somebody you wanted to care about, isn't it?
I'll lay that entirely at Joe's feet, but you do care about them and you care about their marriage. Ultimately, we all know that repressive socialism was a failure. That's not in question on the show. The show is really about the people and the human relationships in this intense moment in history.
I want to play a clip for you now. This is Philip, the husband, and it's he and his wife, and we'll play this first clip and then we'll set it up.
You want to betray our country?
Well, after everything we've done, I don't think it's such a betrayal.
Defecting to America?
America's not so bad. We've been here a long time. What's so bad about it, you know? The electricity works all the time. Food's pretty great. Closet space.
Is that what you care about?
No, I care about everything.
Not the motherland.
I do, but our family comes first.
This guy likes America. It's great.
I think that conflict the two are having really gets to the heart of the show and what is going on in this marriage, and that Elizabeth is a tried and true and stalwart KGB officer. She is as true to the motherland as she was on the day she arrived, whereas Philip, after 15 years in this country, has started to go native a little bit.
But it's interesting because this comes down to, in a way, I mean, yes, it's, you know, spy versus spy and Politico thriller and all that stuff, but in a way, it's a vision of competing economic systems at the height of their competition. I mean, this is 1981, Ronald Reagan's just in office, we still got the evil empire, and the electricity works in the United States.
That's right. These two people came here, they moved into a subdivision, you know, in the suburbs of Falls Church, Virginia, that to people who grew up the way they did in the Soviet Union, which was essentially a very poor country, it would be heaven. It's something almost unthinkable to live like this, which to an average American would be a, you know, fairly ordinary way to live. So I think how the economics of it affect people on a personal level, I think, is a big part of the story we're telling.
I'll confess at the outset, Joel, that this is a completely false romanticism, but there is a little bit of, boy, times were simpler back then as you watch this show, right? I mean, you know, we knew who the bad guy was. We knew where to go get him. The economy was simple. There was no globalism really to speak of. It was just a very basic kind of world.
Yeah.
Well, it was. One of the things we talk about in the writer's room from a storytelling standpoint, boy, it's nice not to have cell phones Cell phones circumvent so much storytelling in modern times. But there's also a reality to that in terms of what their family dynamic is and what life was like growing up back then. You used the phrase at the end of the day, but back then, the day ended at the end of the day. You finished work, you came home, you were with your family. I suppose your boss might call you if it was an emergency, but he wasn't constantly buzzing through in your back pocket all through dinner, all through the evening. It was a different time.
Yeah. You guys have somehow made, well, me, and I would imagine a lot of other viewers as well, nostalgic for the styles and the music and the car designs and the life of the early 1980s. Obviously, a lot of time and care and attention, Joel, was paid to that.
Boy, first of all, it wasn't so bad, was it?
Yeah, right? I know. 30 years later, everything looks good.
The good old days.
Is it expensive? I mean, does it cost more? How much does it cost for an hour of this thing?
It's expensive. It's not cheap. And the combination of shooting in New York and shooting period and shooting spy sequences is challenging on the show, but it's worth it. And you've got a whole different kind of world to explore. And they've really encouraged us to do that at the network, which is great.
The show is called The Americans on FX. Episode 3 airs tonight. Joe Weisberg and Joel Fields are part of the team behind it. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thanks for
having
us. Thank
you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which we bring back our hit series from last fall, the Fiscal Cliff Time Machine, except now it's the State of the Union Time Machine. You remember the rules, I hope. See if you can tell which piece of tape was this year and which one was from last year. Topic number one, climate change. Here we go. Was choice one from this year?
The differences in this chamber may be too deep right now to pass a comprehensive plan to fight climate change.
Or was choice two this year?
But for the sake of our children and our future, we must do more to combat climate change.
I know, it's hard, right? Wait till you hear this next one. It's housing was cut number one from this year.
That would give every responsible homeowner in America the chance to save $3,000 a year by refinancing at today's rates.
Or cut number two from this year.
That gives every responsible homeowner the chance to save about $3,000 a year on their mortgage by refinancing at historically low rates.
You can't tell, can you? I wonder if you can plagiarize your own speech, by the way. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.